I'm Frank Moran. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. And I'm not anonymous. You know, I was drinking. Everybody from Saigon to San Diego knew I was a drunk, and now I'm supposed to be secret about it when I'm trying to do something right. I don't understand that. And there's a guy out there named Gil that taught me that, too. He's told me you can't find Frank in a telephone book. So for those of you that are playing that game, think about it. You know, everybody's been thanking everybody around here, and a lot of times we forget to thank some real special people. And since I'm here, I'm going to do it. We all come in here, and there's a small group from the fellowship in Beaver and Adamsville and Minersville that work their butt off for us all year long. So let's give them a hand. You know, I got to say something else. I've been coming up here 7 or 8 years. I can't figure out now how long I've been coming up here. But there's one thing. I love this place. I've been AA all over the world. And I love this place. And I'll tell you why I love this place. Because it's you people. You are the doers. You know, there's a whole bunch of people in all those states' names that are sitting around clubs and sitting around meetings. And they're saying, I'll go next year. Oh, who wants to go there? But damn it, we are the doers. We're the people that do it. Now clap for yourselves. Now, what it was like and what happened and how I got here. Oh, well. I belong here. Some of you young guys and young gals ain't going to understand this, but most of these old persons will. I'm going to be nice tonight. I was born the day they repealed prohibition. The reason I know that, now I was the first born into an Irish immigrant family, okay, the first male. Now the reason I know that is my father didn't show up for 3 weeks. And we go on from there. When I was a kid, every time I did something wrong, which was most of the time as far as my mother was concerned, she used to say one thing to me that still sticks with me. She'd look at me and she'd say, the curse of drink is upon you. And she was right. You know, I came from an immigrant family out of New York and New Jersey. And we made it, okay? We made it because of the Second World War and because of my family's business, and we began to get money. So I can't tell you I was on the street or whatever. I had a good parochial schooling and reform schooling. You know, I spent 15 months in a place they called the St. Anthony's Bad Boys Reformatory. They called it what the hell it was in those days. And we had these brothers in there. And we had duck every noontime. And I ate duck every noontime because all these brothers carried sticks. If a duck flew over the horizon right now, I'd throw up. Okay. You know, I'm another one. You know, I'm recovering from alcoholism. I don't know if I'm ever going to recover from that parochial upbringing. I'm not sure. The point I want to make here is that, you know, I was brought up and my old man was a bad guy and he was a drunk and all those things. And I'll come back to my father later because there's a lot of young people here and got some feelings about family. And my father is an important thing. My mom was whatever my mom was, and I'll talk about her too. But I was brought up good. I had everything I needed, but I was on the street when I was 11 years old because I chose to be. And another thing was that no matter what happened, I always felt like I was alone. I don't know if you identify with that. I just didn't feel like I wanted to have anything to do with anybody. Even in school, as a youngster, I chose the sports that you did alone. I was a swimmer. I was a cross-country runner. No teamwork. I never did really like people. You know, I tried to stay away from them. I put the front up. I put it up early. And I got in a lot of trouble when I went on the streets. I wasn't hip, slipping, slick, and cool, as Mick said last night. I got caught every goddamn time I did something. And I went to those places, like I was talking about before, and at 15 and a half, as close as I can figure it, I went before this judge again that knew me in Newark, New Jersey. And he looked at me and he said, you know, we talked about our prior meetings and dialogue. And he said, I'm going to give you a choice. You are either going to go into an adult facility, I cleaned that one up too, or you can go in the military. Now, I knew what would happen to me as a 15-year-old in an adult facility, so I chose the military. So from 15 and a half years old until approximately 3 years ago, I was a member of the United States Marine Corps. Right. And all I did was drink. That's it. I just drank and did my thing, whatever the hell that was. Or, you know, my story is no different than anybody else's, and I don't like to get into drunk logs much because, you know, I drank here, I drank there, I did this, I did that. So what? You know? You know, the name of the game is how we got sober. And if you think I came waltzing into the back door of AA and said, wow, I'm glad I'm here, you're crazy. Most of you that know Bob Earl has heard him say, everyone that walks into AA comes in with a little invisible man with a flamethrower aimed straight at his ass. So all you volunteers, I love volunteers, you know. 3 days after they're here, they want to become the president. I was still fighting that at 3 years. And that's what I want to talk about, attitude. I drank and I drank and I had a bout with morphine and I got out of that because the job I was in, I couldn't operate. I was a zombie. So I came off that cold turkey, but I never thought there was anything wrong with my drinking. All those years, there was nothing wrong with my drinking. And the funny thing was, when I was a kid, I got in a lot of trouble. But in the Marine Corps, I didn't get in a lot of trouble. You know, I've talked with some of my friends on the H&I committee, and there's a guy up out here sitting right down there laying, looking at me, named Mike. And we talked a number of years ago at the San Diego convention, and he said something to me about, you know, we all been in jail, it's in your mind. And I figured out that the reason I got over is I worked for the government. Okay. About 15 years ago, it started to get bad. Vietnam was almost over. I had spent a lot of time in the Far East, and I'm not going to tell that story, Mary Joyce. I was back on the island of Okinawa. I was just finishing up a total of 9 years in the Far East for various reasons. Mostly I was running. And you could get away. Somebody said something about half drunk and half patriotic. I was all drunk. And I'd had a lot of trouble. I got a lot of dings. Physical things and maybe mental things, I'm not sure. But anyway, the doctors were beginning to study me, all right? Yeah. I had a plate in my head, and I got creased across the head, and I was beginning to act strange, and they noticed it, and they were sending me to the doctors, and the doctors were examining my head, and I had these headaches, and I had double vision, and I was falling down a lot. So they gave me a number of medications, and I would be all right, especially with the fifth and a half a day I was drinking. But basically what I was having was I was having DTs, and they didn't recognize it. So I volunteered to remain in the Far East again because, you know, I wanted to serve all you people. Okinawa was a nice place for a guy like me in those days. And I got a message back. I can almost remember it verbatim. And it, but the, in essence, what it said was they thought I should return to the United States and review my priorities. And I didn't want to come back, see, because I'd had a lot of trouble. And I've left a lot out, and I've done it intentionally, because I want to talk about living sober. A lot of my problems, I thought, were with American women, all right, and stuff like that. And I was getting over good in the Far East. I liked it, man. But they sent me back, and they sent me back to Coronado, California, and they made me the officer in charge of the Marine Corps Intelligence School, which was interesting. That's what I did for a living in the Marine Corps. You know, if you're an intelligence agent or a reconnaissance type person, nobody ever asks you what you're doing because they're afraid. And it's perfect. In fact, when I was on the island of Okinawa, just before I came back, my job was to go out and investigate the big drug thing that was happening. So I was out there doing it. Right. I'd check in every few days and write up some kind of a phony report and get on my way again. But I came back to Coronado and I didn't want to be there. Now see, I know the difference was that I wanted to be on Okinawa and I didn't want to be here. So it got real bad and things began to happen, because if you're in those days in the Far East, you get away with murder. But you come back here to the States, they start to look at you strange. You know, I do things like, I'd wake up and I'd go, oh, because I was the boss of the school, and it'd be 7:30. And I'd say, oh, God, and I'd jump up and get dressed, and I'd jump up and throw up and have a drink and then put my teeth in and have another one and get dressed real clean and go to work. And I'd start wondering, I'd be walking across the parking lot to the staff school, and no cars were there, and I couldn't figure out why. The problem was it was 7:30 at night. Now, you'd think that somebody, that would bother somebody, you know, in the position that I was in. But it didn't bother me, because immediately my head went, the club's open. And I just went on. Anyway, I had a friend, Staff Sergeant Jim Holds. I'll bust his anonymity. And we used to drink together. In fact, I lent him $40 the night he made Staff Sergeant, and he still ain't paid me. All right? That's not a resentment. And he went away someplace, and he had come back. And he didn't drink anymore. So, of course, I didn't have nothing to do with him. Now, he told me later, a long time later, that I walked into his place, his office one day, and I asked him, Jim, how do you not drink? Now, I don't remember that. But I asked him. And Jim, who was a staff sergeant in the Marine Corps, I don't know why he did it, because he was in trouble, because he was a recovering alcoholic, or an alcoholic in those days. He barged into a general's office, and he said to that general, oh, I forgot something. At this time, I was 4 days shy of a medical discharge. I had already been before my medical board. Right? My discharge diagnosis was and is, and I have a record of it, which is good for about, I think, 18% if I want to go for it on my retirement, chronic psychotic depression. Big deal, huh? There's no such diagnosis. Jim went into this general and he said, there's nothing wrong with the old top. He's just a drunk. And for some reason, the general listened to him. And the next day, this big sergeant major and these two big sergeants came to see me. And they said, get your gear. We're going to take you to the hospital. At that point, I didn't care where I was going. So we went off to Long Beach from San Diego. And they made me go all the way up there without a drink. And they caught me cold early in the morning and it hurt. And they wouldn't stop. And they dropped me off in this place, and I was taken to the original alcohol rehab. I was the second Marine ever to go through that thing. There's a guy sitting right out here. We went through it together. I say one thing about the Navy's program, and we missed the Navy here. They aren't here this year. I have an undying debt, this Marine, the United States Navy, because they took me in. They dried me out, and they pointed my ass straight at AA. Okay? And I went through treatment, and it was nice. Now we're going to talk about attitude. I figured out I was there, so what the hell? You know, and I didn't have any place else to go anyway because they're going to throw me on the street, and I didn't have nothing. I had a wife, but I did. I get into that later, too. And it's kind of hard for me to explain what went on because I don't know. You know, we sat in a room, they had group, and they put us in this bus and take us to meetings. Remember the first meeting? It was on Signal Hill. Some of you know where that is. And I swore to God this place was an old ammo bunker, and they drug us in there. Now, that night was my first night, and I was having, there was nothing wrong with me, and I kept telling them that, but I was having trouble getting, I kept shoving both legs into one leg of my trousers, and the bus was waiting. Well, we finally got down there, and we sat down, you know, and everybody was talking and laughing. I'm sitting around going, oh, my God. And then the first speaker, they had a podium, and it was purple stuff on the front of it. And the first speaker got up, and he says, my name is Sam, and I got 28 years sober. The purple meant church. And this guy said, 28 years sober. And I went, you know, I didn't say it out loud because there's a lot of you guys there, and you look mean. There wasn't no ladies in that meeting. And I just sat there. And then everybody got up and said, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, it came my turn. And what the hell, I was there. I got up, and I said, I'm Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. Anything to get him off my back. Sat down, and then we prayed. And I knew I had to get out of there. And we went to group, and we went to meetings. And I remember some meetings, if there was a good-looking lady there, you know, that's the kind of stuff I was picking up on. And my counselor, God, I'm going to get this over with so I don't forget it. My counselor spoke here 3 years ago. Okay, he's been my sponsor for over 12 years now. He was the kindest, gentlest, toughest man I ever met in my life. And he would take me to the gym every once in a while to prove it. But one thing about that man, I had gone through approximately four marriages by that time and had something like seven children. And you know what he taught me? Or sure, he taught me a little bit about AA. But that man was the first human being I ever felt love for. I love Clarence Pecker. He's what I want to be when I grow up. And he was good. He has never told me but once to do anything because he knew if he told me, I wouldn't do it. I just don't do it still today. If you tell me to do something, I won't. That's the way I am. And it came time for a weekend off, and I'll never forget him. And I said, you know, I was looking to get this passed because I had a lady in San Diego and I was getting lustful. And I said, you know, they were talking about steps, so I figured, what the hell, I'll get them. I said, Clarence, what about these steps they're all talking about? He says, it's right here in this book. I said, oh, good, give me it. And I went in my room, and I hung around in there for about an hour and a half. And I come back to him, and I said, I'm done. He said, what? I said, I'm finished. He says, oh, yeah? He said, why don't you go on for the weekend? You know, we've laughed a lot about that over the years. And I went through, and I came out of treatment, and a lot of things happened. And I don't have the time to go into some of those problems because I want to talk about living sober. I have an attitude problem. I have a problem communicating. I have a terrible, violent streak in me that I've been working on for a long, long time. But it's still there, you know. It's like the compulsion to drink. I love people that come into AA or NA, and they're about 3.5 days sober or 3.5 minutes sober, and they come up to a podium like this. It's always participation meetings, and they grab hold of the podium, and their knuckles are showing white, and they try and look spiritual, and they say, I no longer have the compulsion to drink. And I'm sitting out there in loser's row, and I want to go up and choke that bastard because I'm dying, right? Okay, that's the way I used to feel. I believe you now. I really do. Okay. I fought that for a number of years. I dreamt about it. I walked around about 5 years. I wanted to drink every minute of every day. You know, and I'm glad it was that way for me because it gave me something to fight. If it had been easy, I probably wouldn't have done it. But it's important for me. You know, and a lot of people, when we come to these meetings, and there's a lot of new guys in Gallus here, and young people here, and you come to these meetings, and somebody like me, with a kisser like mine, would get up and say, I no longer have the compulsion to drink. And all of a sudden your head goes, oh, maybe I shouldn't either. So they start saying, I no longer have the compulsion to drink. And they're dying. Bullshit. It's okay to have the compulsion. It's not okay to drink. Talk about it. We're not all as cute as you might think we are or we say we are. It's been attitude. My attitude most of the time is okay today, but it used to suck, right? I tried to get around a lot of things. I tried to shortcut the program. I tried to do a lot of things, and I used to go to Clarence. I don't have much of a story. I did what a guy told me to do after a slip. He said, don't drink, go to meetings, get involved. And that's what I did. And that's kind of simple, but that's what I did. But I had a lot of problems. And most of the time I went to Clarence. You know, when you're violent and you're sneaky, you have resentments. And my resentments go like this, or went like this. Still do today sometimes. I'd have a resentment against you. So I'd sit there and plan. And I'd plan, and I'd plan. And I'd do things like figure out how to burn your house down. Or how I could get my bike group to come by and swing a chain around your kid's neck on his way home from school. And stuff like that. And Clarence came in one day and he said, I bet you were all up all night thinking about that guy. And I said, yes. And he just looked at me and he kind of smiled and he said, I wonder how much sleep he lost over you. And I began to take a look at those things. The way I deal with it today is, I try and deal with it today, is if I've got a resentment to any human being, I'm tired of resentments at places and things. I can't hit them. Yeah. I used to have resentments against, I had a good one for the IRS, but I don't want to talk about that. I do what Clarence taught me to do. If I've got a resentment, if I'm angry, I don't go to bed without doing something about it. I try and come see you, try and talk to you, call you, any damn thing. It works for me, and I share that with you. Yeah. Living sober was hard for me initially. See, I always wanted what you have. I don't know how that works, and there's some guys out here that will really identify with this, all right? But see, I was brought up, hell, from 15 on, I lived on those military bases and those military clubs and around those things. And it's not much different for certain elements of the community either. There are buffer zones that are set up to contain us and entertain us, okay? And I lived in those buffer zones in BC Street and Tudor Street, okay? And the Valley and Yokosuka, nice places. But what I always wanted to do was go live where you live, right? I never told anybody. I wanted to go live on Righteous Street. Righteous Street is a house, okay? I got a friend out here I just talked to today that just started to live on Righteous Street. And I love it. You know, I always wanted that. When I went to AA, I looked around and I saw that. We started going to AA up at that treatment center and went to West Hollywood a couple of times and Westwood, too. That was a different Westwood. And they'd say, if you want what we have, and I was looking around at money, Mercedes, and blondes. You know, and that's what I thought they meant. That was kind of what I was doing. I went to AA for those kind of things, and I figured I'd get it, and I wanted a house, and I wanted a wife that stayed, and I didn't want to fight with her, and I wanted success, and I didn't want to do any steps, and I didn't want to go to any meetings, and I didn't want to do none of that crap. But I did to keep appearances up. And I did a lot of things in order not to do the steps. Like, I always wanted a house, right? My own house. So I bought one. 4 bedrooms and a swimming pool in Otay Mesa, California. And I used to walk around my house. And it didn't keep me sober. All right? And I used to go out and look at that swimming pool. Now, that's the American dream. I'm going to tell you something. You gave me a swimming pool right now, I'd fill it full of sand and plant a tree in the middle of it. You ever clean one of them suckers every Saturday and nobody's been in it? You got to. And I wanted tools. You know, people make things. I got a hammer now. I wanted tools, but this is the way I was thinking. So I went down to Sears and I bought one of everything. And I put it in the garage. And I used to go out in the garage and look at my tools. And they didn't keep me sober. In fact, when I sold them, most of them were in the original box. And slowly but surely, I began to figure out that maybe I ought to start doing the things that you people were telling me to do. All right. And I did them reluctantly. Clarence began to talk to me about total abstinence. Oh, shit. He wanted me to understand what it was and that it really was more than a day at a time. But he told me, for you, let's just talk about a half a day. And he talked about my compulsive this and my compulsive that and my thinking. And he never, well, the best way I can explain it, I didn't figure this out for a day and a half after he said it to me. He said, I'll make a deal with you. He said, I'll continue to be your sponsor if you will do one thing. Every time you have a good idea, call me up. Now, I've been using that for years on a bunch of people, and some are sitting out here, right? See, most of the stuff I use, I got from him. He's a hell of a person. And that is what was wrong with me, my head. Thought wrong. I got a lot of mileage when I first came to AA with this nut diagnosis. I used to go around saying, I don't belong here. I am really crazy. And they misdiagnosed me, and people sat around. They listened to it for about a year or so. And then a guy in South Bay Pioneers stood up in the middle of a meeting and said, why don't you sit down and shut up? You're just weird like the rest of us. Now, I don't know if that fits. For you guys, all right? But I've got a lot of mileage in being weird. I get away with that. And I'm the guy that talks about, Clarence also told me that after 5 years, about the fifth year, I said something about brain damage. He says, you can't cop out to that anymore, sucker. You know, you better start owning your crap right now. And that's what it was about. You know, if somebody'd say something, I said, I got brain damage. Well, I do, I think. There's some people here tonight that have been in those mental health facilities and have those feelings, whether you're calling yourself an alcoholic or not. And I've just got one thing to say about that, and I really feel I have to say this. You know, those places were pretty good. I go in there, and I learned real quick to be, you know, what treatment was and what it was about and medication, and I liked it. I used to love those gray ladies in Balboa with the formaldehyde. I wait for them to come down. But, you know, I got to say this to all of you that might have this feeling that there's something wrong. And maybe there is. Okay? But maybe there ain't. Maybe there ain't. Those places for me were a retreat. They were a warm, dark cave that I went inside and I hid in. You know what? I almost never came out. If it wasn't for Jim Holds, I think I never would have come out. It's a dangerous place. It's a very dangerous place. Because, you know, well, hell, most of you know somebody that's in one of those places, and it ain't no fun. It just isn't any fun. But I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one of the lucky ones. We're the lucky ones. And we went on about sobriety. I had a lot of misconceptions about what the program was about, but I began to work it, and it was slow, and it still is slow. Steps are important to me. Okay. There's a man sitting here that gave me my first inkling of what God was about in his utter simplicity. He sat there and said to a group of us, God is that that makes the grass grow green. I water it, but he makes it grow. And I could understand that. And a guy named Frenchie took me to a meeting in San Diego. It's not there anymore. It was an all-Indian meeting. And I walked into that thing, and I felt like I was at home. And I spent 2 years of every moment that I could get loose from my job in an Indian halfway house in Campo, California. And I learned about God, and I learned about spirituality. There was a lady that used to cook up there, and I'd watch her, and everything she cooked, she would pick up what she was cooking and chew it, and then spit it in a can and say something. And finally I asked somebody what she was doing, because I thought that was kind of weird. And she was saying, thank you, Spirit, for the food you're giving us. Okay? And a lot of people helped me until I could get back into what it was about. And what spirituality was about, and begin to know what that was about, and begin to work on that, and begin to know that the spirit, whatever that is inside of all of us, and we haven't been abandoned. I believe that there is a spiritual part of every one of us, and we need to reach out or get back into it. You know, it's real easy initially in the program to spout the words. But sooner or later, the only thing, as it says in a big book, that's going to be between me and that first drink or that first fix is my spiritual program. You know, because when it comes down to it, I'm the guy that's going to pick it up. And the only thing that can save me is God as I understand him. So if you're fooling around with that, don't. Sobriety's tough. Sobriety isn't easy. There are times today, there's been times in this last year when I didn't think about taking a drink, but I thought about packing the rest of it in. But something stopped me. Mostly you guys. Mostly what I've learned over these past years. It's special. You know? Things have happened, and I have to look back on my sobriety rather than my drinking. Because my sobriety is what counts. I was 38 years old when I got sober, right? And I remember what it was like. I remember the bars in Saigon and BC Street and all those places. But what's important to me is what's happened in sobriety. You know, and hell, I like to, you know, I'll listen to a drunk log or a war story as well as anybody else, but the name of the game for me is sobriety. What I want to know about is how the hell you're staying sober. What I want to know about is how you're handling the problems you got today, because I got the same damn problems. Maybe I can't talk to you about it, but through listening to you, I'll hear something. You know, and it come like two years sober, I was in one of those things. I went to see Clarence, and he said, he says, what's the matter now? And I said, well, I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And I said, but, you know, I'm not having any fun. I said, what do I do now? You know, I'm going to meetings, I'm doing all this. And he just looked at me and he said, now listen to this. He said, why don't you do all the things you always said you were going to do and never did? Think about that. You remember the weekends? What, the weekends we were going to do something? Remember the plans we had for family, for ladies, for guys? The great things we were going to accomplish? And then it was Sunday, and then it was Monday. And I set out to do that. And it's been... I had some fun at it. Did it started it slow. He told me, now wait a minute. Don't jump off and, you know, like the guy that went in the Grand Canyon. He said, you got to do it easy. It's like fighting. Jab a little bit. Don't jump in there swinging because you're going to get knocked on your butt. So it was real slow and real easy. I tried to do things. I tried to reach out in the community. I tried to slowly but surely learn about normies. He told me I ought to learn how to communicate with normies. I thought, oh, my God. Then I thought about the normie women and decided I might try that. And I've had a lot of fun. And I've tried that. You know, it's been a long time. And I'm still trying to do everything I always said I was always going to do, but never did. You know, I feel kind of funny talking to you guys and gals here about doing something. Because you're here, all right? So you do something. I'm talking to the people that ain't. So forget it. I want to tell you, I usually call it the rewards of sobriety, but I'm going to jump around a little bit. I want to talk to you a little bit more about my father and about the steps and whatever. I don't know if this counts as amends because I hadn't reached it at that time, but I just feel I have to feel like I have to talk about it. And I know there's a lot of people that have feelings about fathers, mothers, and all that kind of stuff. You know, my father was an alcoholic, as I said. And I grew up being taught to and learning to hate that man. You know, I remember the fights, the screams, the knives on Saturday night, and all that stuff. But he was a different kind of drunk. I, like so many of us, grew up saying to myself, I'll never be like him. And at 38 years old in a grungy old building in Long Beach, I looked in the mirror and I was him in spades. My old man was a drunk, okay? But he always took care of his family. I never did. Drunk or sober, he got on his knees and said his prayers. I never did. There's a lot of things. He was a clown. He was a clown. One story about my father, and this will explain it. He kind of looked like a drunken Barry Fitzgerald. We always knew he was drunk when he was coming home, but because he'd be carrying his straw hat like this, which meant it was full of puke and his teeth was in it. Well, he got me, and yeah, he was a tricky old guy, you know. He got me one time, and this is one of, you know, to describe my father to you, because as I grew older, maybe because I was a drunk, but I began to see that he wasn't as bad as I thought he was, and I began to have some feelings for him. I came home from Camp Lejeune up to Newark, and it was a Saturday, and I was after a lady up there, but anyway, he caught me, and he said to me, would you go to church with me tomorrow? Now, what the hell? You know, he's my old man, and he was pretty sober. I said, sure. He said, would you wear your uniform? I said, okay. He says, you know it's Holy Name Sunday. I said, all right. He said, well, will you go to communion breakfast with me? I said, yes, Dad. So I spent the whole evening fixing my uniform because I want to look good. Big thing about looking good. And off we went to church, and we went to communion breakfast, and then we left. And the name of the game where I come from is after church, you go to my uncle's bar and have a drink. So off we went to my uncle's bar, but we didn't go in there. We walked on down the street and into this other bar. I said, Dad, what's the matter with... He said, no, I want to take you here. I said, all right. And in the city, you know, you got this block thing, and we were off our turf, and I wasn't sure what the hell was going on. But we went, and we sat down in this Polish bar, and we had two drinks. And my father says to the bartender, "Do you remember me?" And the bartender was real nice, and he was big, too. And he said, bartender says, "No, sir." He says, "Well, you sure?" He says, "No, sir." He says, "Well, me name is Tom Moran." He says, "You threw me out of here last year. And here's my son home from the Marine Corps to kick your arse." What are you going to do? You know, you got to go for it, all right? You got to go for it. And that's the way he was. If you want what we have and the rewards of sobriety, the blondes, the Mercedes, the BMWs, the money, sure. We all want that, you know. And, you know, we say, "Oh, I'd like to be sober," but we want that. We want that. At 2 years sober, I went home to Newark, New Jersey, and went to St. Michael's Hospital to the chronic inebriate ward and spent the last 10 days of my father's life with him. And the last words he ever said to me were, "Francis, are you getting enough to drink?" Now, I didn't sit there and tell him about AA or anything like that, but I did one thing I could die on right now. I held him in my arms and I told him I loved him. And it wasn't too late. It wasn't too late. And when it got time to make amends, I saved the last amends for my mother, because I figured out it was all her fault. You know, the curse of drink is upon you. So I went back to Jersey, and I sat there for the whole weekend. Now, my mom had been a big, huge woman, 6'4", big woman who handled people in mental health facilities. Some of you are familiar with that. And I was going to make amends to her. I was going to tell her about all the things that made me like I was and that I didn't drink anymore. And we didn't talk about, excuse me, alcoholism or anything like that where I come from. I don't think they still do. But I sat there and I practiced and practiced and walked and went out on the stoop and went out on the stoop. Now, by this time, my mom was a real old lady. And she had shrunk down to about this big on me. And she walked in a walker. And finally, she came out on a porch, and she looked at me, and she said, "Are you still not drinking?" And everything was okay. Everything was okay. And I knew, you know, that it was okay. She did what she did because she was my mom. You know, and she tried. And who the hell am I? I didn't get to see her before she died, but it was okay. And it's important, you know. Those things are really, really important to me because they're the rewards of sobriety. They're the rewards of what this is all about. You know, being here and doing this, this is the rewards of sobriety. And sometimes we forget what the rewards are. And sometimes we're looking for something more. I remember when I first got sober, I went to work for 2 weeks every day. And I couldn't understand why no one noticed. Now I was there, I was sober, and God, why, you know, they should say something. I was just doing what the rest of the folks do. But I wanted some recognition. I always wanted some recognition. I wanted somebody to say, "Yeah, you were there." I had a lot of marriages, a lot of relationships. I had a lot of children. Okay. A lot of children. You know, it seems like men don't talk about their children and their lost children and the children they lost. The only thing I'll tell you about my marriages is that when I got sober and did my inventories and did my fifth steps and my four steps and all the rest of that and took a look at my past life, what I had to look at is there was nothing wrong with any of those ladies that I was married to. It was me. It was me. And I tried to make amends where I could, and some of them weren't accepted, and I don't blame them. But I had a real hurt inside of me about my children. I got sick one time, real sick. I ended up in my living room on a mattress, and I didn't have nothing else to do and no more excuses, and I couldn't make any excuses. So I made a tape to my oldest daughter in New Hampshire, and I sent it to her, telling her about me. And I started to receive letters and began to communicate. And when my mom died, I called her and I said, let's get together in Jersey for the funeral. And I remember walking into this house and I rang the bell. It wasn't my house, my sister's. And this beautiful young lady opened the door. And I couldn't believe it was my kid. And we got to know each other. A couple of years later, that's one kid, okay? When I was doing everything I always wanted to do, but never did, me and my partner got on our motorcycles in San Diego one summer and took a ride to Maine just to see if we could. But in New Hampshire are all my children, and we went to see him. I want to tell you something, and I don't know if my partner knows this or not. I think she does. I was terrified when we crossed that state line. I was terrified at the kids, and I was worried about warrants, too. We went up there, and it was really funny. There was five kids there and a grandkid, and I got to bounce a grandkid on my knee, which was really neat. There's more now. The oldest daughter, she loves me. The next daughter, she loves me. One son was kind of like this. The other one tried to make a run on my partner. Okay. He's my kid. And the youngest one, who was 12 years old that time and I'd never seen before, she just didn't know what to do. But you know, it was okay. There wasn't any talk about forgiveness or anything. We just got to know each other. And it's been fairly good communication since then. But that meeting killed some of the hurt. You know? I used to sit in places and watch young people and sit with groups like the Easy Does It Riders. And young people would come in and I'd be there with all my leathers on and all that shit, you know, playing Macho Man and the whole bit, or my Marine uniform. And I'd be looking at the young people and saying, I wonder what my kids are like. So you guys that are sitting out there, go find out. I found out that time heals even whatever we did to them. Relationships are funny too. Sober, I had to take a look at my relationships, and I decided that it might be a good idea for me to become a monk. Or have weekend relationships only. And I talked to Clarence about this. And he told me, he said, have you ever lived alone? I said, not really. Because I was the kind of, if the relationship was breaking up, I was going to have another one over there or something. You understand. And he said, why don't you go live alone for a year and see how it works? I said, oh, okay. And that was one, he said, why don't you? So I didn't have to do it. So I went back and I told him I'd think about it, which, you know, that's whatever. And I got back, and a week and a half later, I got orders to the island of Okinawa. So I went to Okinawa, where I had never lived alone, and lived alone for a year. It was interesting. There was 11 people in AA in the island of Okinawa. We made up a list, 52 topics for meetings. We had a meeting every night and two on Sunday. We lived in each other's back pocket. 10 guys and one lady. And we just hung tight together. The lady was interesting. She was a colonel's wife, and she was sneaky because she had to be anonymous. She would come in late, come through the back door, do whatever she had to do because of her status. And what I could never understand, I worked in headquarters up on the hill, and they had the only salmon-colored Grand Prix on the island of Okinawa. And on the back of it was an Easy Does It sticker. But they were anonymous. Don't mention my name. And I, you know, our old man was a drunk, and I used to, he'd be coming up to work, this colonel, and I'd see that car, and I'd just crack up laughing. But, you know, that was a good year. I found out I could live together, live alone, and it wasn't that bad. I didn't particularly like it, all right? But I could do it. A lot of times it really sucked. But I could do it. There were interesting things that happened in Okinawa, and I got to tell you the airplane story before I quit, because that it was a spiritual thing that happened to us over there. There was a group of us, the AA folks, and there's a AA convention type thing in Japan. Now, we were on the island of Okinawa, and four of us decided to go. And we could get the time off because we all had the clout. And we were going to go, but my friend Pete, he was working with one of these, he had a little rehab center, and he had 42 of the most animalistic young Marines you ever seen in your life. You know, they were 18 and a half, or they were a day, and they were all addicts or whatever. And Pete said, it would be a good idea to take them. They need it. And he was right. But they didn't have any money. Anyway, I had access to the military message system, and I got permission to send out a message that there were 50-some Marines and sailors on the island of Okinawa who wanted to go to Japan to an AA convention. And we needed a ride. You should see my boss when I went to him to get this thing signed off. He really thought I was really strange. Anyway, we got a message back, a verbal message that said, if we went to Kadena Air Base on Saturday at such and such a time, a plane would pick us up. So we did. Me and Pete and John and Pete's 42 animals. And we corralled these suckers in a corner, and we said, all right, we're waiting for an airplane, and we're going to Japan. Now, these kids were ready to go to Japan because they figured, what the hell? But we got there at 5 in the morning. And by 5 in the afternoon, now the Air Force guys were telling us, they were saying, there's no plane coming for you people. We've got no plane scheduled. And I was saying, Pete, look at me, and I'd say, oh, it's okay, there's a plane coming. Don't worry about it. By 5 in the afternoon, Pete and John were looking at me real strange. And they were saying, are you sure? And I was going, have faith. Anyway, about 6 o'clock that night, there came a call from the Navy side of the field. They said there's a DC-6 or 10 or whatever over here to pick up a bunch of people going to Tama, Japan. That's us. And we got on the airplane. It came over. We got on it. We didn't ask no questions. A free ride. We got up there to Japan. There was a bus waiting for us. I don't know how the hell a bus got there. It was waiting for us. We went up to Tama, Japan. We had 3 days of the damnedest AA you ever seen in your life. We had one speaker was AA, one speaker was Japanese. They had interpreters. Didn't make any difference. I sat in the front row. I didn't give a damn what language it is. When somebody believes and they're working the program, it comes across. And we got on our funny Air Force bus that I didn't know where it came from. And we rode back down to the base. And we got on the airplane that was waiting for us. And they took us back down to Okinawa and we got off. And I said a prayer, and so did Pete, and so did John. The kids were, they didn't care. I came back to the United States, okay? And 3 years later, I found out what happened. That message flew all over the Pacific. There's a Navy Reserve Squadron in Alameda, California. The executive officer of that squadron is a member of our fellowship. He saw the message, and he sent the plane. Now, you tell me if that ain't spiritual. You know, it's things like that that make me believe, you know, when everything else says it isn't going to work, it will. Now, I talked a lot about spiritual, and I got to say, tell you one more thing Clarence told me. Early on, whenever I got in real trouble, I learned about AA and I learned about the words. And when something was going down, I would talk. I would say something like, "I've turned it over." I came in, or Clarence came in one day, and he said, "What has gone on about whatever? I can't remember the situation." And I looked at him and I said, "Spiritually, I've turned it over, Clarence." And he looked at me and he said, "God is busy making avocados and sunsets. Get off your ass." And he's right. Relationships. I was going to be a monk. I don't know how I got into this. I was still into the monk thing. And I did that year with 7 days off for good behavior. Since I booked my own plane ticket. And came back to San Diego and went about my business at my job. Single and alone, except on weekends when I had money. That don't count. And I hung around, still do hang around. A lot of my sobriety was found in a halfway house in San Diego named South Bay Pioneers. You can usually find me around there. They know where to get to me from there. And I used to go down there for noon meetings a lot. And I went down one day with some of the people I work with. One of these people was a clergyman. That's a strange trip. Never mind. And I had a friend who I had met. He was, at this time, after Okinawa, the manager of this halfway house. When I first met him, it was when I first came into AA, right? And he was a dog catcher, but I thought he was a cop. And I thought he was in South Bay Pioneers to make sure everything stayed nice. Yeah. Crazy dog catcher. He pulled in one day in his, he called himself, I forgot. Canine social worker. And he pulled in one day with his animal control truck with a fishing pole hanging out the back and a hot dog on it. Now, there's a lot of people here that, this guy's name is Jim S., and there's a lot of Navy people here that don't know who he is because you know him by the name of Gramps. He's a neat old guy, but he was managing this halfway house, and he came out to me and he said, "Listen, I want you to meet a lady." And I went into my act right there in front of God and everybody in AA. I said, "What kind of lady?" He said, "She's back here in the office. Come on in. You need to meet her." I said, "Is she alcoholic?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I don't want to meet no alcoholic broads." Too sick. You know all the crap. Two sickies don't make a welly. Right? I got enough goddamn troubles. I don't need to sponsor one of them. Now everybody's listening. Everybody's listening. And he said, "Oh, come on." So I walked back in there and I walked in and I met this lady. I speak for myself. We've been on a honeymoon ever since. Okay. A year later, we got married. Today is our 7th wedding anniversary. So be you, male or female, and you're sitting out there. I know we shocked somebody at a Milford the other night when somebody said they've been divorced 11 times. I think we've got 8 or 9 between us. I honestly believe that our higher power, you know, we're here because he put us here. And we went through what we went through because we needed to go through it. And we're all here right now for a reason. I think it's service. Is one thing, and what we have to do to reach out to other people. But the other thing I believe is that for all of us, there is a partner. Okay? For all of us, there is a partner. So if you're out there wanting to be a monk or a nun or whatever, look around. Okay, and don't assume before you. I've been eating them words for 8 years, you know, and there's nothing I can do about it because they got me. It's there, you know. All right. I work the steps. I work them today. The steps are like a wheel, right? And I'm a hub in the middle. The steps are part of my life. You know, I can stand up here and try and be cool and say all kinds of neat things, but that ain't where it's at. Any one of us can do that, but have a little bit of time. Or maybe if you're good, not so much time. The name of the game is what we do when we get out of here. What we do on the street. What we do in our home. I submit to you that our program begins in our home. Right. Being neat and commit in AA meetings, don't get it. It's what I learn and take to the street. And at 5 years sober, I was doing all those things. And I felt like crap. And I went back to Clarence and I told him, I said, there's something wrong. I've done this, I've done that. He says, that's right. I said, it's not working. And for the first and only time in our relationship, he told me to do something. And I'm going to share that and one other thing with you before I leave. He said, you need to go see this guy. I said, why? He said, don't worry about it. Go see him, listen to him. So I did. And the first time I heard him was in Minneapolis. The second time was in L.A. And the third time was in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And he tells the same story every time. He's a kind of a little wimpy guy, ineffectual, gentle, kind, loving, beautiful man. And he was or is some kind of a minister, and I don't know what kind he is. It doesn't make any difference. But he tells the same story every time. And he talks about the prodigal son. And I heard it the first two times and nothing clicked. And the third time, I heard it. And all of us know the story of the prodigal son. And I'm going to give you my literal interpretation. All right, and if there are any members of the clergy in the audience, this is my interpretation. This kid, the prodigal son, don't like it at home. All right, and he goes to his father and he says to his father, give me my inheritance. I'm leaving. And his father gives it to him. And it says in the book, he squandered it on riotous living. Now, don't tell me you don't identify with that. Where he ends up is doing chin-ups on the gutter. And he slinks. And again, my interpretation, he slinks back home. And his father sees him coming. And he opens his arm and he says to his servant, he says, let's have a party. Our son has returned. Or our daughter. Now, I don't want to talk about this guy's brother. His brother was a schmuck, all right? Let's just forget him. But when his father says, let's have a party, our son has returned, this kid stops, and he stepped back, and he wasn't sure what to do. Now, what I got out of that, because it hit me just like somebody smacked me with a wet towel, is I was doing everything right, I thought, except for one thing. Like the prodigal son, when everybody said, and when my father said to me, as he said to all of us, here, you're back. I couldn't move forward because I couldn't forget the past. I couldn't forgive myself. And I submit to you, no matter how well you do in this fellowship and on this program, until you forgive yourself for the past, it won't work. It won't work. So if you're carrying that bag of crap, get rid of it. We are God's children. I'm going to close with one thing. It may sound kind of strange, but I've had to think about this and work on this because of some of the stuff I do. And I ask people this, and I ask you. Now, I got a friend. I have I've got a lot of biases and prejudices. I've got a friend who I love and respect, and I walk into him, and when I see him, I say, "How you doing?" And he'll look at me and he'll say, "I'm sober today," and I want to reach over and clout him. You know, what you promised me, what I saw in your eyes, and what I found, what I felt from you was that there was something more. And there is something more. What we get here in Beaver is something more. If all there was being sober today, I'm speaking for myself, I wouldn't be. There is something more. What do you get out of this fellowship? Because you got to get something. I looked at it. What keeps us coming back? One word. You can put any word you want on it. These are mine, okay? Hope. That's what I found. I found hope here. I saw it in your faces. I saw it in your eyes. I felt it. The lady named Millie who kept hugging me, no matter how hard I pushed her away. Mary Joyce's mother who patted me on the head. The hope. So you keep doing it. And I don't know why, but you keep doing it. And things begin to happen if you work at this. And all of a sudden, hope is replaced by faith. Faith. It is going to work. Those promises are going to happen. And all of a sudden, you've seen it and I've seen it. And maybe we don't see it in ourselves, but all of a sudden we begin to see people who stand up straight and begin to walk straight and don't have to slink and don't have to hide. There's a power in that. And it's not ego, it's a power, because I'm doing what's right. And you're doing what's right. Where do we end up? For many of us, it's a return to dignity. Dignity. For this guy, it was to know dignity. To know love. To know you. And maybe let you know me a little bit. I wish you the dignity of sobriety. Thank you very much.